My 2024 postcard from China, recorded on Tuesday, the 16th of April, 2024. Earlier this month, I returned to China and visited Shanghai, Beijing, Shenzhen, and Hong Kong. The purpose of this memo is to reflect on what I saw whilst traveling around these thriving megacities and what I heard in many conversations with friends, fellow investors, business people, and artists. I published a memo after returning from my first post-COVID trip to China 1 year ago. I wrote then that I was skeptical before the trip about how much one person can learn from spending a few days in a country as vast as China. As it turned out, I was pleased to report quite a lot. This time too, I was skeptical, and this time too, I was surprised about how much I learned. In contrast to last time though, my feelings are more mixed about whether this is a good thing. Wearing my investor hat, I am pleased to glean insights that perhaps others overlook. It is what makes the job of an investor stimulating and, I hope, profitable. Wearing my citizen of the world hat, though, I am concerned about how little is known about China and the West. There is both opportunity and risk in the relationship between the two blocks. If we do not have the most basic understanding of China, we may miss out on the former whilst maximizing the latter. So, what did I learn? China is a tricky topic. China is a tricky topic to talk about, and not only in China. I met with two-time Oscar winner and four-time Academy Award nominated director Malcolm Clark. Malcolm was one of the first Western journalists allowed into China in the 1970s under Deng Xiaoping's open-door policy, and spent 2 years researching the Cultural Revolution. He returned to China in 2014 to make films about China's development in the intervening period. His films depict China in a favorable light. Realistically, no other type would make it past the Chinese censor. But, and this is the crucial point, China's story, seen through the lens of the 1970s, is a positive one. Importantly, the films do not shy away from tough topics. Both elements come across in his documentary Drive Like a Girl, which I was fortunate to have a viewing of with him in Shanghai. For his troubles, Malcolm has been cancelled by some people in the West. His claim to fame could well be to being the first person to be censored both in the East and the West. The East because a film he made about the early days of the COVID pandemic in Wuhan has not yet made it past the Chinese censor. This strikes me as a great shame, as what the West requires is a full picture of what is going on in China, not just an anti-China picture. His experience also gave me pause before writing this memo. I see a similar risk of alienating some people in the West where it seems that anyone not aggressively anti-China is perceived as a sellout. I view myself as neither anti nor pro-China, just curious. I hope that anything I write here or elsewhere is taken in this spirit. China has many strengths, some of which I touch on in this memo, but its Achilles heel is the lack of free expression. Free expression is the wellspring of creativity and innovation. It is the source of new ideas and the mechanism for ejecting bad ones. If the West is to succeed alongside China, it needs to lean into its strengths. It needs to celebrate alternative points of view, not shut them down. The door is opening. I wrote last year that China is unnavigable for non-Chinese speakers. I'm happy to report that the situation has improved since. WeChat Pay works well now, which is essential as neither cash nor credit cards are accepted outside international hotels. Some WeChat mini programs such as Rideshare are also available in English, which is great for getting around. Western apps work with an international phone number, though not with a local one, I should add. And visa requirements have been lifted for certain countries, making it easier to get in and around the country. Jordan from Trip.com, China's largest online travel agent, told me about a big spike in visitors from visa-free countries, the aim of the program, so I would not be surprised if it is extended further. There is still further to go to make the country navigable for non-Chinese. I was not ready to give up on my handlers to accompany me around the country yet, but that could be more a function of how smart and entertaining they are. Thank you, Juan, Patrick, Luke, and Yuru. Overall, I'm encouraged that China is making it easier for people to travel to China and in China. If the world is to understand China better, people must go there, so this is a development worth celebrating. Megacities are thriving too. I wrote last year how livable China's tier 1 cities have become and would echo that again. Shanghai may well be one of the most attractive cities in the world to live in today, in terms of architecture, food, infrastructure, public spaces, safety, and above all, affordability. Most importantly, for those of you who know me well, it has the highest concentration of coffee shops in the world. The Trip.com campus had over 10 coffee shops in a 50-meter radius, three of which were right next to each other. I had to take a picture, having finally located heaven on earth. See image. If you are worried about being overwhelmed by choice, I'll make it easy for you. Either M-Stand or Arabica. So how do Chinese Tier 1 cities stack up against the world's great cities? I observed a fascinating natural experiment that provided an answer of sorts. I arrived in Hong Kong in the week after Easter, when many Hongkies take off on vacation as it coincides with the tomb sweeping holiday. Hong Kong had a net migration of 1.2 million people out of the city. Many went across the water to Shenzhen, where the border crossing was swamped. They are unanimous about why. The hotels, restaurants, and service are better and cheaper on the mainland. The architecture is not bad either. See video. The following weekend, though, Hong Kong was packed as the Rugby Sevens, a sporting event that is a cross between the World Cup and the Oktoberfest, took place. It was a lot of fun. The message is clear. Like everyone else, Hong Kong must compete for share of wallet. Companies are thriving too. China is home to large, innovative, and increasingly international businesses. Some of these are well known, others less so. In the former bucket is BYD, the world's largest manufacturer of new electric vehicles, or NEVs for short. I had the good fortune to visit their campus on the outskirts of Shenzhen. The scale and breadth of its operations are so far ahead of Western OEMs, it will be tough for them to catch up. In the latter bucket is Mindray, which I also saw in Shenzhen. It develops and sells high-end medical equipment for patient monitoring, in vitro diagnostics, and medical imaging. It is gaining share in Chinese and Western hospitals, largely at the expense of giants such as GE, Philips, and Roche. As a younger company, it is more efficient than the incumbents that have enjoyed supernormal profitability for decades. The West seems to have woken up to the competitive threat of Chinese internet giants, and perhaps car manufacturers. I do not believe, though, that it appreciates the progress in other industries. The success of Chinese companies is broad-based and sustainable. For Western investors, they represent attractive investment opportunities, given the depressed valuations today. For Western companies, they represent a grave competitive threat. And for Western policymakers, they represent, well, a headache. More on this topic later. The economy is in a tough spot. Whilst many companies are thriving, the economy is not doing well. What was clear from my meetings with local investors and businesses is that China is going through a tough economic downturn. There are bright spots. Trip.com sees sustained travel demand even after the post-COVID boom has worn off. However, they are few and far between. More often, the talk was about the consumer downgrade, i.e. consumers trading down from Western-branded goods to local brands, or more likely from local brands to unbranded goods direct from the factory. Our investment Pinduoduo benefits from this trend, given its ultra-low prices and consumer-to-factory business model, which I describe in my 2023 letter. The reasons I heard for the downturn are not new. A slump in the residential real estate market due to excess capacity, local governments strapped for cash, a vacuum in decision-making due to a corruption crackdown, lower job security due to reductions in force, and uncertainty due to regulatory crackdowns, most recently in the healthcare sector. If you are hoping to hear from me when the bottom will be reached, I'm afraid I will have to disappoint. I do think, though, that the passage of time should fix all these issues. Excess housing supply will work its way through the system, companies will start hiring again, and officials will adapt to new guardrails. The question is not if a bottom will be found, but when, if indeed it has not already happened. I learned more on this topic at the Present Value Summit in Shanghai, organized by my good friend Shinya Deguchi. One investor pointed to data that housing starts have fallen 70% since their peak in 2019. At the same time, urbanization continues, and much of China's older housing stock needs replacing. After 5 years of declines, he argued that the market should return to equilibrium soon, and pointed to parallels to the US housing market after the great financial crisis. Fingers crossed he's right. Shinya wrote in his invitation that the summit was inspired in part by RV Capital's annual gathering in Engelberg. I appreciate the call out. Never did I imagine that Engelberg would reverberate as far as Shanghai. A depressed economy is not a defeated economy. Whilst China's economic travails may be well understood, bad news seems to travel fast when it comes to China. How average Chinese employees and businesses are responding may be less well understood. An assumption might have been that the Chinese are realizing their limitations and dialing back their ambition. But nothing could be further from the truth. People are working harder and companies are competing harder. Here are two anecdotes I heard reflecting the resilience of the people. Anecdote number one. I heard about one family who had fallen on hard times after the husband lost his job as a property broker in the real estate downturn. His wife's response, quote, "People do not die from poverty, they die from laziness," end quote. Taking the hint, he put on the yellow jacket of a Meituan delivery driver and now makes food delivery at night as it pays better. On a typical shift, he does 30 to 40 drops at 7 RMB per drop for a nightly income of roughly $30. She works full-time as a waitress and does food delivery after her shifts as well. Asked who takes care of their 6-year-old child, she responded that he sleeps on the back of the motorcycle. They have cut virtually all non-discretionary spending except one item, after-school tutoring for their child, in robotics of all things. This is not someone you can keep down. Anecdote number two. I heard from an Asian investor with teams in Singapore, Indonesia, and Beijing. He told me that if he sets each team a project for completion by next week Friday, the Singapore team will hand in their work by 6 p.m. on the Thursday before. The Indonesian team will report back on Friday and ask for an extension to reach some people with some essential information. The Beijing team will hand in their work the following day and ask if there is something else they can do. You do not want to compete with the Beijing team. Competition is intensifying. Companies are responding to the harsher economic environment by competing even harder with each other, if such a thing were possible. I saw so many examples of this, it is difficult to know where to start. I met with ZTO Express, the leading express delivery company in China. Competition continues to be ruinous, with the average price per parcel now below 2 RMB, or roughly $0.25 per package. And yet consolidation remains elusive, despite most of its competitors losing money. Luckin Coffee and Coty compete for dominance in the budget coffee shop market. The price of a cappuccino continues to spiral downwards and is now just 8.8 RMB, or just over $1, with no signs of a truce in sight. And just when you thought there could not possibly be another NEV manufacturer, Xiaomi throws its hat into the ring with the SU7 and pulled in over 50,000 orders within the first 27 minutes of sales. See image. Companies are going west. Increasingly, companies are also looking to go overseas. There are several well-known examples of this, such as BYD, PDD, and ByteDance. I expect the trend to accelerate, pulling in smaller businesses and a wider range of sectors. I heard of many entrepreneurs who divide their time equally in and outside of China and build their businesses in parallel in China and overseas, or simply skip China altogether. Zoom was an early example of this phenomenon. The entrepreneurs I met gave three reasons for building their businesses this way. First, competition is much more benign overseas than in China. Second, the economy is tough in China. And third, there is much less personal risk overseas. If you screw up in the West, you declare bankruptcy. If you get on the wrong side of regulators in China, you can end up in prison. Barriers are lowering. It is also getting easier for Chinese companies to expand overseas. Thanks to digital advertising, it is easier to find customers. Gone are the days when you must build up a local organization and hire local salespeople. This is a phenomenon from which Meta, one of our investments, should continue to benefit long after e-commerce companies dial back their ad spending. Thanks to AI, it is also easier to provide support and compile documentation in foreign languages. This is potentially an overlooked but impactful consequence of ChatGPT and co. From the perspective of a Chinese entrepreneur, the no-brainer play is to go overseas. The welcome is getting frostier. Not everything is improving for Chinese entrepreneurs. The welcome they can expect in the West is getting frostier. Europe and the US seem increasingly concerned about the impact of Chinese companies on indigenous industries, in particular the auto industry. The US has implemented trade tariffs and export restrictions on semiconductor equipment and chips to slow Chinese companies down. The more hostile environment has not gone unnoticed by Chinese entrepreneurs. They are adjusting their business plans accordingly. In some cases, they are simply de-emphasizing the US. Whether this is a good or a bad thing for US consumers remains to be seen. In other cases, entrepreneurs are relocating to places such as Singapore and, where possible, taking on the citizenship of their host countries. They are also relocating factories, including their entire Chinese workforces, to countries such as the Philippines or Mexico. That way, they can credibly argue they are not Chinese businesses. A view in the West is forming that if Chinese companies become too much of a threat, they will simply be cut down to size through tariffs, regulation, import bans, or whatever other tools come to hand. It is not clear to me if this is the right policy. Remember, China's rejection of foreign technologies and manufacturers contributed to its decline leading up to the century of humiliation. Moreover, I doubt it will work. What constitutes a Chinese company will be increasingly difficult to pin down, as described above. Western consumers will become increasingly restive if they are forced to buy inferior products at inflated prices. For example, countries without an indigenous car industry will be only too happy to accept Chinese NEVs. How will consumers feel in neighboring countries that are forced to buy the obsolete products of their declining industrial champions? And China itself is not without leverage. If German OEMs want to continue to sell to their most profitable market, is it not reasonable to insist that Chinese companies can sell in Germany? Geopolitics is the biggest risk. Likely the biggest obstacle to the relationship between China and the West is geopolitics generally and Taiwan specifically. The view in China is that Taiwan and China are one country. This is how Taiwan sees things as well, with just one ever so slight difference that Taiwan sees Taipei, not Beijing, as the capital. There does not seem to be any desire in China today to force the issue. The view is that time is on its side as the country becomes stronger economically and militarily. Reunification is inevitable from a Chinese perspective. This dynamic could change towards the end of a Xi presidency, but that is several years away, and the CCP's priority today is clearly the economy. What would change this dynamic in a heartbeat would be any developments that were perceived to foreclose a, from a Chinese perspective, favorable resolution of the Taiwan question. The stationing of nuclear weapons in Taiwan or the prospect of Taiwan joining NATO would be considered examples of foreclosing actions. In such an instance, China would likely feel it has no choice but to force the issue from its side. I do not want to wade into the politics of this. However, if you like the status quo, by far the best option is simply to kick the can down the road. If you simply must have the question resolved, good faith negotiations about a deal acceptable to both sides are the route to go down. All other roads lead to an abyss. Kicking the can is underrated as an activity. Pessimism rules. It is well understood that Western investors are pessimistic about China's stock market. What surprised me on this trip is how many local investors are too. This is not universal. Xinye titled his conference, "Spring is Coming." However, optimists were few and far between. In Hong Kong, I met Asia-only funds that had a lower allocation to China than the Business Owner Fund, a fund that can invest anywhere. They preferred Japan and India, stock markets that have performed far better in recent years. They pointed to several reasons for their pessimism. The government has struggled to get to grips with the property crisis. The economy remains in the doldrums. Regulation is increasingly unpredictable. China's relationship with the outside world is deteriorating. And years of poor stock market underperformance have drained their, and perhaps more pertinently, their LPs' reserves of optimism. I am more optimistic. As is likely clear from this memo, I do not share this pessimism for the most part. China has a large and growing number of world-class companies. The workforce is hardworking and highly educated. The economic downturn is more likely cyclical than structural. Moreover, it has positive side effects. It forces companies to be more competitive and expand their horizons overseas. I do not see trade tariffs as an insurmountable obstacle, and poor stock market performance historically likely creates pent-up gains prospectively. What I do see the greatest risk is geopolitics. I am encouraged by the steps the Chinese government has undertaken to make it easier for foreigners to visit and hope this leads to a better understanding of the country in the West. Aside from this, though, there seems little to be optimistic about, with a US election around the corner and the Taiwan question unresolved. Any resolution is likely to prove elusive. Until then, one can debate the probability of conflict, but presumably everyone can agree that it is non-zero. In a worst-case scenario, investors' skepticism on Chinese equities will be well-placed. However, many non-Chinese companies will be severely impacted as well. At least in the case of the Chinese companies, this risk seems to be priced in. It is unclear to me that this is the case in the West. As I wrote in my 2023 letter, the goal of investing is not to avoid risk, which is in any case impossible, but to get paid for taking it. Thank you for listening and happy investing.